Jim, what are some things that we can celebrate that we've witnessed over the last 15, 20 years? Undeniably, you referenced that we're not knowledge keepers and knowledge providers. I'm seeing curricula around the world and jurisdictions and organizations kind of balance out the realms of the curriculum from not just being a knowledge-focused curriculum, but a do curriculum, curriculum with skill embedded in it. And then the know plus the do equals the understand. Students have a deeper understanding of the content and the standards if they're able to apply them and put them into practice and transfer them to other settings. And so, gosh, a know, do, understand curricular model that didn't exist 30, 40, 50 years ago. This is really revolutionary, and it's really just sensible. It's really just really good planning forward in terms of the skills students need to flex and sharpen over time as they're learning the what of our curriculum. So that's a big shift that we've seen over the last, I'd say, 20 years. More schools, districts, jurisdictions adopting a really clear disposition slash competency focus to their curriculum. So there's a balancing there. It's not just what you know. It's what you do with what you know that really, really empowers a student. Additionally, something to celebrate is I'm seeing really amazing things being done in the assessment realm of teaching and learning. I'm seeing great assessment policies. I'm seeing great assessment protocols. I'm seeing assessment being a we job rather than a me job. A teacher can't be the owner of the assessment realm of teaching and learning alone. If we are to propel growth and impact student growth, we need more student involvement in the assessment realm of teaching and learning. And so, it starts with a really fantastic assessment policy that talks about the things that we value, the things we do, and the things we don't do. And then you start to see different things in classroom experiences where teachers are empowering students in the assessment realm of learning. So I'm seeing some really amazing things there. Additionally, let's get to some limitations currently that we're seeing. I'm still seeing some limitations in that big jump to higher ed to university. I'm seeing some universities really shift teaching and learning to be much more student-centered, but undeniably, I'm still hearing from senior level teachers, I need to get them ready for university. I need to do it this way to get students ready for that thing later on in university. And I don't wait for universities to change, Jim. I don't wait for, professors or colleagues in higher ed to change their practice. I focus on the good things that we have before us. And certainly my job is to not prepare students for an assessment framework or a teaching learning experience in university. My job is to teach the curriculum and the spirit and authenticity of the curriculum as it is before me. I do think that's a limitation, but certainly I'm not waiting for them to change different things for students then for now. So does that one make sense, Jim?
That makes a lot of sense. In fact, I just recently had a discussion with practitioners who were complaining about universities, about
Yeah,
the
there you go.
for
Yeah.
universities. One of the things that I say to my kids is that, but how is this going to get me into university? And I says, okay, look, in terms of the IB, here's what you do. So, do you want to go to university? Is that what you want to do? Then contact university and ask them, what do you have to do to get in? What repertoire do you have to do? What do you have to know? What, and let's just make a list of the things you got to know in order to do that. And we'll just incorporate that in the study. That won't be the primary focus of the study. But in the course of you figuring out the things that you want to do, the music you want to play, the music you want to create, we'll incorporate that thinking into it.
Lovely.
I know that there is, certainly with arts teachers, a very big frustration about the arts in general and what colleges and university and the pressure the colleges and universities are putting on students to be admitted into their universities, and how actually the arts in terms of enrollment suffers those last 2 years in school. And I think that probably will be a completely other podcast, but I do hope and I do feel that there will be some thinking, a change of thinking going on with universities in terms of what are they expecting from the kid? Who is the kid? Why does the kid do the things they do? How do they know that this kid is going to use their knowledge in peaceful and productive and positive ways and not just know the knowledge to know the knowledge? There is a lot of work to do there, and that gets back to the question as far as what you see the challenges are. I do think that there's been progress made, but I think there's a long road ahead. I think there's a long road ahead with that topic of it. And that's why I think that what we do with critical thinking, critical listening, inquiry-based learning, it's very, very important to stay on that path and continue to move forward. And those doors will eventually open up. What do you see 5 or 10 years from now?
Well, I continue to see growth in terms of the areas that we've already celebrated and discussed. You know, I think teachers, as we continue to see pockets grow in schools, we begin to see a critical mass. I think we're going to see an evolution of thinking and an evolution, that's a mouthful, an evolution of practice. I'm really interested, Jim, in embodied learning. And embodied learning, of course, in the arts, this has been long part of the philosophy in terms of the arts, but the embodied learning pieces, of course, you know, our students are just not a brain on two sticks, you know, on two legs. They have a body, they have heart, lungs, organs, there's feelings there. And I believe teachers are going to really begin to harness the research around embodied learning and embrace some of how we get students, the whole student, prepared for learning and get them in a place where they're ready for next steps. So I think the next 5, 10 years, I think there's going to be a lot more conversation around embodied learning. And then I think we're going to see some different practices in assessment. You know, I'm seeing, and we see it in the IB, Jim. We see it with, you know, in the PYP exhibition, right? We've got this beautiful showcase of learning. And I think we're going to see more of that showcase of learning to a public audience. I think we're going to see a breaking down of the walls of the classroom, so to speak, where more student articulation and voice with regards to sharing their learning to a public audience is going to happen. And again, I know that happens a lot in the arts, but why does it only happen in the arts? Why isn't it happening across other subject areas? I think we're going to see more of that practice and that honoring of students and celebrating of students be at the heart of assessment. And again, we're seeing this at schools around the world already. I just don't think it's taken off as much because sadly, schools are data driven and schools want to see the impact of what do these practices, you know, long term do for students. And so I think we're at a tipping point here in the next few years where some of these dominoes are going to be pushed over. And as teachers begin to see what inquiry is and what inquiry is not, I think we're going to see a lot more inquiry at schools around the world as well.
And this has been just a lovely discussion, and we keep on moving on. I must be mindful of the time here. One of the topics of your workshops and of your book is that you were talking about the levels, the different venues. I remember the swimming pool. That was such a strong illustration for me about the levels of inquiry. And like I say, we could have several podcasts on this, and I tried to emphasize this a little bit in some of the information that I got out of your book on the website. Could you highlight that a little bit for us? Could you tell us a little bit more about these levels? I know you could talk for at length
No,
about
happily.
these,
Yeah,
but could you
happily.
give us sort of a quick surmise of what these levels are and how we as music teachers might be thinking of those?
Well, I'd love your input as well as a music educator, Jim. So for you know those listeners, I'll just, you know, let's visualize a swimming pool, you know, where we have the shallow end of the pool and the deep end of the pool. And as we do, as we kind of wade into the shallow end, we could feel that the depth of the pool change underneath our feet, can't we? So if we can imagine a swimming pool that has four depths from the shallow to the deep end, these actually reflect the four types of inquiry. And so from the shallow end, we have something called structured inquiry, and then we transition to controlled inquiry, then guided inquiry, and then the deepest end of the pool is what we call free inquiry. And so these four types of inquiry really reflect a change of agency over time. You know, the deepest level of agency. And see the more voice and choice for students, of course, is in free inquiry, the deep end. And there's less voice and choice in the shallow end. It's much more of a teacher-directed inquiry in structured inquiry, the shallowest end. So, you know, sometimes, Jim, well, I can't say sometimes, often when I visit a school and we talk about inquiry, you know, teachers merely think about inquiry as free inquiry. They kind of compartmentalize all inquiry as the deep end of the pool, whereas there are, in fact, four types of inquiry: structured, controlled, guided, and free. As a kind of a mapping tool, you know, when we look at our curriculum through the lens of these four types and begin to move around different objectives and standards. Where in our curriculum would structured be beautiful, and where our curriculum would free be beautiful? And then even how do we want to time that out depending on the skill acquisition of our students? We don't want to throw them too quickly into the deep end in fear of they'll be anxious and overwhelmed and uncertain and free unless they've acquired certain skills that allow them to be competent and confident and free. So the types of inquiry, these four types, are a little bit of a curricular mapping tool, and also skill development tool across time. What I want to see in classrooms I visit is I want to see a change of agency over time. Do I need to see all four types in Jim's class? No. Do I need to see all four types in every teacher's class? No. But I do want to see a change of agency over time. I want to see students not just acquiring certain skills, but I want them to be able to take on more ownership of agency over their learning across time. We can easily find that graphic. You can just Google it, Jim, and listeners will be able to see it to really drive home the visual. But
I'll put a
it is a mapping tool. It is a planning tool for us to consider how we're looking at our curriculum across the lens of agency over time with students, if you will. I'm curious, as a music teacher, Jim, when you look at that swimming pool graphic, what really jumps out at you given the music experience with students?
Well, as you're talking about this, as you're saying this, I come back to these recent workshops that I had when teachers come to us. What do we have to know? What do we teach? What are we doing? And what you said earlier about you still have to know the curriculum. I actually use the swimming pool metaphor, which I hope listeners will have a chance to look at, of moving from structured inquiry to free inquiry. I'll put it together in a musical sense. If you're teaching Mozart, you still got to know what a whole note is. You still got to know some very, very basic things in terms of music, how music works. You still got to know what key signatures are. And a lot of that inquiry is structured inquiry. You can guide students to theory sites, you can show them scores, you can analyze things with them. You could say that this is a G and it moves to the relative minor and the relative major. And then out of that comes chords. And it's important to know that stuff, and it's important to use that stuff. Of course, we have to know that stuff. But in terms of really understanding it, the student needs to move from, so why is Mozart relevant? Why did Mozart write that? One of my favorite questions is, I mentioned it earlier, if Mozart were alive today and looked at his work, he would probably listen to it and say, why are you guys still doing it this way? You have so many different choices. You have so many different things you could do. So after our knowledge of the basic technique, the basic theory, proficiency of music expands, and you see that in the students, you want to get them to, you use the term, I think, and I used it, ungoogleable questions about things that they could do with chords, how they could alter chords, how they could alter whole steps and half steps, with the same basic structure, the same basic knowledge, but now they're free to move on to completely new ideas. Basically, this is how music evolved, isn't it? We went from Baroque to classical to romantic to contemporary, 20th century, to jazz, to world music. All of these things were a reaction to something that happened previously. And I think that it's important to see those connections. So, yes, it's important to have that structured inquiry. And I think that this is, you mentioned curriculum design. I think that that is an excellent tool for vertical alignment, saying if a student is going to be here and we're going to talk about these concepts in music, they need to know these things. But there's another part of that. They need to know why those things are important, not just that a whole note gets four beats and four times. They got to know why it works that way. And that's, I find, sort of the shift in the approach to thinking, the approach to teaching and learning with using inquiry to make it relevant and to make it purposeful.
You know, Jim, you've got me thinking about other settings as well outside of music, because you're referring to this notion of, well, students need to know this critical information in order to apply it to why it's important, or maybe a free inquiry experience. In every subject area, teachers say something really similar. You know, in the math setting, they say, well, they need these foundational experiences and understandings to take their learning deeper, right? Or in the literature setting, it's the same thing. They need to know how to write before they can actually become a poet, right? And yes, and it becomes problematic then when we just get stuck in that teaching mode where we're just giving them all the things that they need to know and we're showing them all the things, and then there's no agency, there's no application, there's no relevance, there's no contextual tie. And so everything you're saying, I'm like, yeah, I've heard something similar from other teachers in other subject areas. The challenge, the tension is we can't sit in that area of the pool the entire time with students. We can't live in the shallow end of the pool, can we? If we live in the shallow end of the pool, there's not a change in dynamic there in the learning. It's essentially a teacher-directed inquiry all year long. Again, what does Trevor look for in schools that he supports? He looks for a change of agency in every setting. So it, you know, if you are in structured inquiry, we have to be mindful of how long we're there for, where are there opportunities to empower our students to take more ownership and apply this knowing, apply this content to a real world application. That's a really important, you know, intentional reflection that we need to engage in is, are we staying here too long? And how can we empower our students sooner than perhaps we're ready for? Because oftentimes the biggest restriction to inquiry is the teacher mindset, not the student capability. So I just wanted to raise that up, right? Sometimes we do it to ourselves, don't we? We chain the learning in the class because we're living in the shallow end a little bit too long than perhaps our students need us to be there for.
Yeah, as you're talking, I'm thinking again of the ensemble music director, say the band director. You warm up the band, and what do you usually do? You play a scale, and then you play the scale over again, and then over again, and over again. Well, okay, I got that. Now the water is, I'm not even swimming anymore. I'm standing in the baby pool. Okay, I got that. What about taking that warm-up scale and applying it, playing it backwards, or taking a motif from that scale, taking a segment of that scale and making a melody? What about playing it upside down? What about playing a modal excerpt, applying it to modes? What about improvising on that scale? What about how were the scales
What
that you?
about asking your students what could be done differently now? You know, now that we got this down, what could we do differently now? And maybe calling up a student to show everybody, right? Like, absolutely, there are a dozen ways that we can go about doing that differently once we've got the first down pat. And I think that's precisely it. It's that curiosity of the educator. What would happen if we did it differently? What would happen if now we can move on differently? That's a nice little analogy there, Jim. I love that one.
I always thought that there was an art to addressing inspiring, probing questions. Do you have any thoughts on that? How could teachers develop the art of relevant, inspiring, motivating, passionate questions? What would they be looking for? How could they move forward in inspiring,
Well,
motivating,
that's
passionate?
such a great question, Jim. Absolutely. And
Yeah.
I don't want to take the artistry out of the art. So my response feels a little bit mechanical. So forgive me, but you're absolutely right. There's an art there and there's a nuance there. And in part to get us ready for that artistry and that nuance, I suggest teachers decide on a little handful of questions that they're going to revisit often. So write down four or five or six kind of thinking questions, if you will, that when you ask students these questions, they could really settle into some reflection and some thinking time. And gosh, having those four or five or six questions each individually, it's going to help us practice the art of questioning, essentially. So, you know, find those four or five or six questions, write them down. Some teachers write them down and they tape them to the back of their staff badge, right, Jim? And that way they can lift up their badge and as their little cheat sheet. I need to remember to use these thinking questions. The other piece, once we have our thinking questions, the other piece is we need to give our students time to settle in and bite into these thinking questions. Oftentimes teachers ask these thinking questions to the whole classroom. And there's that kind of awkward silence at first, which I love to live in. That's good. But then we see that the same hands go up, the same hands respond to the questions. And all students are becoming used to is, you know, there are a handful of kids in the classroom who will answer these questions first, and they begin to wait and outwait each other. So those students just continue to dictate the learning in the classroom. I love to engage in a turn and talk. You ask that thinking question, you say, I'm going to give you 2 minutes to turn and talk. And every student in the room will turn and talk with a peer, and you just walk through the room and you listen to the thinking in the classroom. So you're not just hearing from the same four students who put their hands go up. You ask the thinking question, you engage in and turn and talk, and you actually go through the room and you use their discourse as formative assessment to guide next steps. Where are they at? Where is their thinking? What can I lift up from the room and kind of highlight to everyone else in the room? How can I maybe let students share their thinking to everyone else in the room? The thinking questions matter. And then the negative space that we create to allow students to engage in discourse, that's a really important move because you know what teachers want to do? Teachers want to get moving on in the learning. They want to get moving on to the next step. But gosh, if you have to ask a thinking question, give students a couple minutes to chew on that question with a peer that they trust. The easiest way to get there is a simple turn and talk. You know, something for teachers to consider, count how many turn and talks you do in a single lesson, in a single day, or in a single week, and just monitor the difference in your students' thinking and your students' responses as you engage in more turn and talks across time. I know we don't have endless amount of time to give space for student discourse, but in classrooms I visit that engage in a lot of turn and talks where it's routined, gosh, the student discourse, the conversation, and then that dynamic of teacher with students, it's totally different. And in part, it's because of the turn and talk, if you will, Jim. So that question about the artistry of questions, it's a really good one. What are our five or six questions, thinking questions we ask students? And then, how do we let them have time to engage in the thinking of the question and use that to guide our next steps? I think those are three moves we could all make.
That question of time comes up almost in every workshop. Yeah, I know this is great, but I've got a concert, or I've got this, or I've got this program I have to prepare for. Again, I think it's very, very important to give reflection, to give thinking. You have to give it time, regular
You
time,
do.
even if it's 5 minutes.
You do.
And you say, but
Yeah.
I can use those 5 minutes. I think it's going to be time well spent if you just give, even if it's writing in their journals, what was your takeaway today? What was your main takeaway? What did you get from that?
Yeah.
And
This
really
is going to
important.
be one of those. This
Really
is going to
important
be.
moment. That's a really
Yeah.
important moment
Yeah.
in developing this.
Yeah. This is going to be one of those early moves teachers make, giving students a little bit of time to engage in that discourse, that reflection, that thinking. And when I say it's a little move, because as we routinely engage in that, we're going to see a progression of agency. We're going to see a progression of reflection and thinking and ownership and critical thinking, and as you've referenced several times, critical listening. You know, if we begin to do those small moves early in our interactions with students, it's a trajectory that we can't get to without doing those small moves earlier. And
Absolutely.
so that's something teachers need to kind of embrace is this isn't going to be high yield now in this moment. It's going to
Absolutely.
be informative. It's going to be high yield as I build these experiences upon one another over time. And there's going to be a progression there. And that's why I said keep track of how many turn and talks you do in a given lesson, day, or week. Because what I'm going to ask you to do long term is see how those turn and talks are getting you a different return on investment in several weeks or even several months. It's again, it's a small move now. Little bit of time now feels like a sacrifice. It's a great return on investment in several weeks and months once we've created that culture where this is building upon one another to really embrace student voice, choice, and thinking.
There's about 100 things I want to say right now, but I'm very mindful of the clock, and I want to respect all that. So let's leave it with one last question. Do you have any closing thoughts that you'd like to specifically share, not just to an IB teacher or a music teacher, just in general? Any closing thoughts about inquiry, music or non-music?
Yeah, you know, I just think it's a beautiful time to be an educator. And I mean that sincerely, Jim. I think of colleagues who, you know, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants now. And it was such a different landscape of education 20, 30 years ago. And our access to conversations such as this, our access to professionals around the world, experts in the field, it's never been so equitable. The door has never been as open as it is now. And, you know, I invite people that are listening to find those voices, find those spaces that are exciting, that challenge your thinking, that clarify next steps, because it's such a beautiful time to be in education. And Again, evidence of it is a conversation such as this. We're on opposite sides of the globe. We've met each other, face to face a few times, virtually a few times, and to be able to connect and have a conversation such as this, what a beautiful time it is to be in education. So I suppose I just invite people to find those voices around the world that inspire them, that challenge them, and guide their next steps, Jim.
Trevor, in closing, I just want to say thanks for your time. I know you're very busy and I know you have to get going, but I very much respect and honor and thank you for the time that you've given us. It's again continues to be an inspiration to talk about these ideas and these concepts. And I can't help but think this is just the beginning of using these into even bigger ideas and bigger presentations. So I'd like to thank you. I highly recommend to our listeners to delve more into some of Trevor McKenzie's work. It's very, very inspiring, and you'll see all sorts of connections being made there between what he's talking about and the IB program in general, but specifically the IB Music DP program. Trevor, thank you. Thank you very, very much. I've enjoyed this. This hour has flown by for me. So I appreciate your time.
Grateful for you, Jim. Keep doing the powerful work you're doing and helping music teachers around the world. Thank you for your time as well.
Thank you, Trevor.